Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Every now and then, I get a little bit of inspiration in my email inbox, and today's episode is from one of those inspirations. Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn, and at trenthorn.com, you can send direct messages to me, either to book me for an event, if we ever get to have events again, and to send direct messages to me. Now, I'm not able to reply to every single message that's sent to me at trenthorn.com, because there's so many that I receive. I'm more able to consistently reply to messages that are sent to me through trenthornpodcast.com for our premium subscribers, of whom I am very grateful and thankful for their support of this podcast. You all make the podcast possible. But I got a message at trenthorn.com that was interesting. It was very short. It said, Trent, can you please listen to the Matt Walsh show and help him out on the Kalam cosmological argument? Because I think there are a few things with it that he doesn't understand. So Matt Walsh is a Christian conservative commenter at Daily Wire. And so I went and checked out his podcast and listened to a few of the episodes. Normally, Matt has been talking a lot recently about COVID-19. I mean, who hasn't, right? And he's really fixated on things related to shelter-in-place orders, mandatory lockdowns, and whether they're going too far. And I actually find a lot of common cause with Matt on this issue and a lot of similar issues. So I like Matt Walsh. I think he's a really cool guy. I'd love to meet him at some point in the future. So I thought it was interesting that he would take issue with one of these popular arguments for the existence of God. So I listened to two episodes, the portions of the episodes. He kind of does listener mailbag, like I do mailbags here on the podcast. And in parts of two episodes, episode 462 and 463, he addresses the cosmological argument for the existence of God. So what I want to do in today's episode is just listen through his commentary and then offer my commentary as kind of a reply where I may agree with him, but also in many cases where I disagree with him on this argument. Also, I want to issue an apology. I know in the previous pre-recorded episodes, I was planning to have my debate with Pastor Steve Christie on the deuterocanonical books of Scripture. That's temporarily postponed, as you can imagine, mostly because our office is very limited. We have limited access to the office, really only for taping Catholic Answers Live. So we don't have access to the studio, which is where I would like to record doing a debate like this, both over Skype and with the studio audio. So we need to figure that out. So I'm hoping that he and I can have this debate on the Protestant Old Testament canon and whether Christians should accept the Protestant canon or the Catholic Old Testament canon. Stay tuned for that. We'll hopefully get a date here in May or June and not have to delay it too much longer. So, all right, let's hop right into the episode here. I'm not going to share everything that he said. I think this started with an open mailbag where Matt was talking about arguments for the existence of God and ones that he thought were good and others that are not so good. And then he got listener mail correcting him, well, criticizing him for his criticisms of the cosmological argument. So I'm just going to start there and then offer some of my thoughts.
You know, what are the best arguments for God? And I know that there are some Christians, many Christians probably, who you talk to who would basically say that every argument for the existence of God is great and persuasive and compelling and decisive. But that's just, you know, that's obviously our bias talking.
Now, I agree that there are stronger and weaker arguments for any position. So when you look at atheism, like what are the strongest and weakest arguments for atheism? I could tell you that the problem of evil, especially the evidential problem of evil, is probably the strongest argument for atheism or the view that God does not exist. The weakest argument for atheism might be probably the Santa Claus argument that, oh, you shouldn't believe in God for the same reasons you don't believe in Santa Claus. And other shows, I've shown why that argument spectacularly fails. Others are really weak arguments for atheism, saying things like belief in God is the cause of war and strife and conflict, or is the cause of most conflict in the world, which is factually incorrect and also irrelevant. Just because a belief causes people to be in conflict with one another doesn't prove that the belief is false. So arguments for atheism based on the detrimental effects of religion or saying that it's just wish fulfillment for believers, those are the weakest arguments for atheism. So when it comes to belief in God, I do think that arguments for and against the existence of God there are stronger ones and there are weaker ones. Like the absolute weakest arguments for the existence of God. And you can look at a variety of these. Go to Peter Kraft on his website, peterkraft.com. He lists 20 arguments for the existence of God from his book with Ronald Ticelli, The Handbook of Christian Apologetics. So he's got 20 arguments in that book, and they're not equally strong. There are some that are much stronger than others. At the very end, you've got, I think number 19 is the argument from Common Consent, saying that we should believe in God because most people throughout history have believed in God. That's a very weak argument. I mean, it's a slight indicator that humanity could be onto something, but it's not a slam dunk by any means. I also think weak arguments for the existence of God are those that go something like this. Evolution is false because of X, therefore God exists. These would be creationist arguments to the existence of God. Now, I think that the theory of evolution is true and that theory is not false. I could always cover that in a future podcast. If you disagree, you can send me a message at trenthorn.com, you know, and maybe I'll do an episode like how Matt's getting criticism from his listeners. I'll get criticism from mine and I'll address that in a future episode. But saying, well, evolution is false, therefore God exists. My problem with that is, well, I think there's no good evidence evolution is false. I think God made us in his image. He used the process of evolution to do that. But even if it were the case, the theory of evolution were false, it wouldn't prove that God exists because biologists and atheists could say, okay, there's some other natural means to explain genetic diversity and the diversity of flora and fauna in the world without having to appeal to God. Now, I think there are strong arguments for the existence of God, and I think cosmological arguments, arguments that take the universe as a whole as evidence for God, are very strong. Matt disagrees with that, in particular with the Kalam argument, so let's see what he thinks of all of that.
Because some arguments are better than others. And you say that the Christian apologists all say that this is a really compelling argument. Well, okay, but of course they're going to find it compelling. See, but when you're making an argument, apologetic argument, you're not trying to convince Christian apologists because they already share your assumptions. There are certain basic assumptions we bring to the, obviously, we have a certain worldview, we bring it to every discussion. And so if a certain argument is compelling to people who share your basic assumptions, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be compelling to people who don't share that assumption.
Okay, so Matt's point is he thinks that the cosmological argument for God is not very compelling to atheists. It might be compelling to Christian apologists, to people who defend the Christian faith, but Matt thinks that atheists don't find it very compelling. Now, I will say if someone's an atheist, they don't find any arguments for the existence of God compelling because otherwise they'd cease being an atheist. But of course, they could say some are stronger or weaker than others. Now, and so I think he's right that we shouldn't get stuck in an echo chamber and think, oh, we all love this argument, so it must be the best. Well, you got to go outside the chamber, outside the group, to see what other people think. But at the same time, many Christian apologists are former skeptics. So certain arguments convince them of the existence of God, and they then became apologists. It's very common that apologists were once skeptics or non-Christians and became Christian. And for a lot of them, I think they would say the cosmological argument was key in their conversion. I think it was for Edward Faser, for example. He studied William Lane Craig for a bit. Now he's departed from Craig. He defends Thomistic cosmological arguments based on Thomas Aquinas. But I think he said that was very compelling for him. Not necessarily the kind of argument that Craig defends now, William Lane Craig, but the ones that he defends. So I think that when we look at what apologists find helpful, both from their own personal conversions and also from their conversations, they do debates and they engage in conversations with non-believers. They may see these arguments firsthand and have a good feel about what works and what doesn't. So we shouldn't totally discount that.
And so I think it's interesting if you can get an atheist, a thoughtful atheist who's going to be honest about it, and ask them what do they think the strongest theistic arguments are. And I've heard, you know, many atheists give their opinion on this. And you're not going to hear them say the cosmological argument. What they will say oftentimes is the fine-tuning argument. That was, in fact, Christopher Hitchens said that he thinks that's the strongest argument for theism. Which, that doesn't mean that it's necessarily the best argument just because Christopher Hitchens said it. But if someone who does not share your underlying assumptions, even they say, okay, that's a pretty strong argument, then that should tell you something.
Now, I agree the fine-tuning argument for the existence of God, saying that the universe has finely tuned physical laws and constants that allow life to exist, and it's not due to necessity or chance, but design. I do agree that's a strong argument. It's in my book, Answering Atheism. I've used it in previous debates. I know that Hitchens was persuaded by it. Richard Dawkins thought it was a strong argument. he went after it at length in his book, The God Delusion. But I know other atheists who are not impressed by the fine-tuning argument at all. Luke Muehlhauser is somebody I read set many years ago when I wrote Answering Atheism. He had a great website, commonsenseatheism.com. I think he's moved on from the theism-atheism debate. I've noticed a lot of apologists for atheism. They kind of get disenchanted with the whole thing pretty, you know, after a few years. And the ones that do stick around for a long time, they're kind of kooky and not the most fun individuals to engage with. But I think Muehlhauser, when he listed his arguments that he thought were compelling, the cosmological or contingency argument was pretty high up there. Now, fine-tuning is a good argument. The only downside I see for it sometimes is that it can deal with very abstract or difficult notions in physics and astronomy that can go over people's heads pretty quickly. But otherwise, it's a good argument. I think maybe I'll do a show on it here in the next few weeks and we'll talk about it more.
So there's that. In general, though, with the cosmological argument, I think, okay, here's the basic problem I have with it. When you argue that, the universe had to have a beginning because it's illogical, right, for something to have no beginning, for it to exist forever. So it had to have some sort of cause, and then God is that cause. Well, it seems like what you're trying to do is to say that it is illogical, it's a logical impossibility for something to have no cause or no beginning. But if it is a logical impossibility, then that would also apply to God, right? Because even God cannot do things that are logically impossible. God cannot make a rectangular square, right? Or a circular triangle. That's a logical impossibility. It's nonsensical. So the whole thing about can God make a boulder too heavy for him to lift? It's a logical impossibility. And so sort of the answer is no. And there's no real problem there saying no.
What I would say in this discussion is that for the past to be infinite, that we exist in the present and the present has come to be after an infinite past series of events have transpired, I would say that that is logically impossible. That is something that cannot obtain based on philosophical arguments related to set theory and the infinite. But it's not the kind of impossibility that is immediately manifest. So I think that Matt, as he talks about this, he thinks, well, infinite past, it doesn't seem as logically impossible as like a square circle or a married bachelor. No, I'll agree it's not like that, but it's more like an impossibility, like a maybe not logical, but a metaphysical impossibility when you think about the nature of reality itself. So there's some things you could say, but it turns out they're not really obtainable. They're not metaphysically possible. So there are things like an object that has the property of color, but not the property of having a shape. That's the example I've given before on the podcast. Imagine something that's red, but doesn't have a shape. At first, you think that's possible. But when you drill down harder, you're like, no, if something has color, it's got to have a shape. Otherwise, the color would be meaningless. Another example would be it's possible to go back in time and kill your own grandfather or go back in time and become your own grandfather. You know, that's or become your own father. It'd be, you know, a little Marty McFly stuff, Back to the Future. More you think, I'm always like, I want to introduce my kids to movies I loved in the past. I'm like, that formed my childhood. But I couldn't imagine sitting down with my son, like, let's watch Back to the Future. Like, is his mom trying to sleep with him? Yeah, but it was the more cool time travel stuff that I remember. Don't dwell on that part. But so the point is the impossibility of infinite past, it is impossible. It's just not manifest immediately. But when you think about it more and you do philosophical thought experiments like Hilbert's Hotel that William Lane Craig puts out, or the Grim Reaper Paradox Alex Pruss puts out and others, you see it's it is something that is not possible given the nature of time and reality.
So it seems like the argument's trying to make a logical case, but then that would apply to God. So what if you say, well, you know, something has to have a beginning, or, you know,
it would not apply to God. I'll go into this in more detail, but it doesn't apply to God. It only applies to a series of temporal events in a timeline. So if God does not undergo temporal change, if God is not quote unquote in time, and that's something Matt has a problem with, then it would apply to God. If God was in time like us and he made the universe, but he existed in a previous timeline and just made the universe while sitting around. Augustine asked about this. St. Augustine said people were asking in his time, what did God do before he made the universe? Augustine said a common joke at the time was, well, he's making hell for people who ask questions like that. But what he said, in all seriousness, nothing, because there was no time. God is just a perfect, changeless, present and eternal now. God existed in a timeless way or atemporal way. So the argument doesn't apply to God if God is not a temporal being, a being that is in time.
Something has to have a beginning, and then God is the beginning of the universe. Then, of course, the atheist response is, well, then who started God or who caused God? And typically, this is where most theists will kind of scoff at that response and say, that's silly. It's actually not a silly response. It's a totally legitimate, logical response to your argument, because you just said that everything has to have a beginning. Well, God is something, isn't he?
Now, Matt is right that if you formulate the argument in an imprecise way, then you're liable to these kinds of contradictions. And I'm sure there are lay people who put the argument out there in an imprecise way. And there's atheists who put forward, you know, dopey village atheist arguments. But and it's funny, and Fazer talks about this, I think, in his book, Five Proofs of the Existence of God. He just gets really annoyed when philosophers claim that theistic philosophers, those who believe in God, whether they're Christian, Muslim, Jewish, whoever it may be, deist, that they say the cosmological argument is everything has a cause, the universe is a thing, so the universe has a cause, that causes God. You know, if everything has a cause or everything has a beginning, yeah, you've got a problem. That goes straight back to God. You know, well, what's his beginning? What's his cause? Oh, well, he doesn't have any. Well, you could say the same thing for the universe, but that's not, cosmological arguments aren't formed in that way. When you put that objection forward, it's true, that kind of argument is subject to what Arthur Schopenhauer, it may not have been, but it's attributed to Schopenhauer, 19th century philosopher. He called that the taxicab fallacy, where you take the taxi to the point where you need to go, and then you just dismiss it like a hack. So you say everything needs a cause. Okay, the universe needs a cause. That's God. Does God need a cause? And you dismiss the taxicab. No, he doesn't need a cause because... But if you say everything that begins to exist needs a cause, or everything that can fail to exist needs a cause, and if God is just the kind of being that doesn't fail to exist or never began to exist, then it doesn't apply to him for a good reason. So it's kind of like when somebody says, you know, what's pulling that locomotive? What's pulling the boxcar? Well, another boxcar. What pulls that boxcar on the train? Another boxcar. Yeah, but is it infinite? No, the whole train is pulled by a locomotive. Okay, smart guy, if the locomotive pulls the train, what's pulling the locomotive? Asking what made God is like asking what pulled the locomotive. The locomotive is a different kind of thing than a car. It explains the whole train's movement. Much the same way, God is not a being in the universe. God is being itself and explains the universe and the properties that it possesses.
So it seems like it's trying to make a logical argument that it then abandons when it comes to God, and that doesn't quite work.
The simple arguments do, like everything has a beginning or everything has a cause, not the more refined arguments.
You know, there are ways, atheists have ways around this. Well, they'll say, yeah, well, we know that there was a big bang. We know that the observable universe has a beginning, but we don't know what happened before then. And we also don't know, you know, we could live in a multiverse. We could live in a bubble universe where there are trillions, maybe infinite number of universes, and we're just living in one little section, one little bubble that started 14 billion years ago, but that doesn't mean that the entire thing started 14 billion years ago. Maybe every black hole contains its own universe. There's all kinds of maybes and what ifs, and all that sounds implausible. It sounds implausible to me too, but it's not impossible logically. It could be true. I think all the atheist needs to do is argue that it's at least possible that we live in an eternal multiverse. It's a possible thing. It's not scientifically impossible. And if you agree to that, which I think you have to, because it is scientifically possible, then it kind of destroys that argument, I think.
Okay, a few thoughts on this. First, possibilities come cheap. I mean, anything's possible. That's not a fatal objection to an argument just because somebody could say, yeah, but this other explanation is possible. Well, so what? Anybody can pose a possibility. What we want to look at is what's probable and what the evidence points towards. So a good premise in an argument is not one that rules out every single possibility definitively. That would be great, but you're going to have a hard time finding a lot of arguments like that in philosophy. Rather, a good premise to an argument is one that is more likely to be true than false, And so if the argument doesn't have errors in its reasoning and premises that are more likely to be true than false, then you got a good argument on your hands. It may not be convincing to everyone, but as Matt notes in his podcast, the mark of a good argument is not whether it convinces someone, because somebody could have a hard head, a hard heart, both, and not be able to accept that. So I don't think the fact that someone could stubbornly say, oh, but maybe there's some other possibility. Okay, but you still haven't really shown what's wrong with the argument or why I shouldn't accept this premise that seems true, even if you do. Also, this is a stronger objection to the scientific evidence for the beginning of the universe. So if you're doing the Kalam argument and you're saying whatever begins to exist needs a cause and the universe began to exist, there's two ways you could show the universe began to exist. And William Lane Craig pursues both options in his apologetics. You could argue philosophically, based on the nature of infinity and time and space, that the past series of events in this timeline or any timeline could not be infinite. And you would get kind of a definite argument there because you're using philosophy and mathematics to establish your conclusion. If you're able to establish it definitively there, it's harder just to raise, well, it's possible something else objection. Matt's objection that, well, it could be possible there's some other thing we haven't discovered about the beginning of the universe, that's a stronger objection to the scientific evidence. And Craig, in the Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology, Craig teams up with James Sinclair. He's a former U.S. Navy warfare analyst and smart guy. He's read through the scientific journals, technical journals. And in that, the Blackwell Companion, I remember when it first came out, I was like, I got my $150. I'm ready to get my Blackwell Companion. Oh, well, what actually happened was I found the Blackwell Companion in Natural Theology for free online. It was a PDF at a random website. So I downloaded it, but I felt bad. I felt like it was stealing. So I ended up buying it later I felt like I stole it. I don't think it was a grave sin, but you still feel like, you want to respect people's copyright, and they probably didn't mean to put it up there for free. So in the Blackwell Companion, they have a defense of Kalam. Craig handles the philosophical arguments against an infinite past, and Sinclair handles more the scientific arguments. So the scientific arguments are, science is always going to be tentative. Science can never definitively establish a truth. It just kind of establishes a truth, and then it waits for it to be rebutted or refuted or overthrown with later scientific advances.
But going to the argument for consciousness, now, as I said, I think that is the strong, at least one of the strongest arguments for theism. Along with the fine-tuning argument, I think is strong. And there are others too. The argument for morality, I think, is strong. But the consciousness argument, now you say the atheist response to that is we would have evolved consciousness because it's very useful. Well, yeah, I could see how consciousness is useful, but this is not a question of why is consciousness useful. It's how could inanimate matter first become animate, become life, and then develop somehow a sense of its own self, because on a purely materialistic basis, we are all just atoms, right? We're all just collections of atoms. So how could it be that a collection of atoms could come together in a certain way to develop an experience, an awareness of its own self? That to me seems like it is impossible. Even almost a logical impossibility. And so it demands some other kind of immaterial explanation, especially when consciousness itself appears to be an immaterial thing. And so that, I would argue, gets us away from, or it pokes a huge hole in, at least, materialism. And now you've opened the door for God. And that's why I think that's a compelling argument. But again, I'm speaking as someone obviously with a huge bias, so that's just...
And that's the end of episode 462. I'm going to go to the next episode because in the mailbag, he continues this discussion. So we'll stay with that. But I'm glad that he discussed what he thought was a very strong argument for the existence of God, because if somebody says, well, this is not a strong argument for God, then I would like to know what kind of criteria they use to evaluate whether an argument is strong or not. Now, I'm not as familiar with the argument from consciousness. It's not one that I employ frequently in my apologetics related to atheism. It's just not an argument that clicked with me as much. But other people really enjoy this argument. J.P. Moreland, a evangelical philosopher at Biola University, has a whole book on it, The Argument from Consciousness for the Existence of God. Arguments related to consciousness, though, kind of like the scientific arguments for the beginning of the universe, they start to get very complicated when you deal with philosophy of mind, neuroscience, other things like that. So that's one drawback from the argument. It's not a major one. But for me, there's kind of more two drawbacks to this argument. One, and Matt kind of alludes to this, the argument doesn't really definitively show that God exists. It more simply shows that materialism is false. That shows that reality is not simply material. There are immaterial aspects to reality. And one of those immaterial aspects of reality is our own consciousness. But then, and this is one of his objections we'll see soon to the cosmological argument, he says the cosmological argument isn't good because it doesn't really show God exists. Well, the argument from consciousness doesn't get to God. It just shows that consciousness, cannot arise from matter alone. Well, maybe there is an immaterial aspect of the universe that we are unaware of that isn't divine but allows consciousness to exist. Also, what I find interesting here is that Matt's critique of the cosmological argument is you're simply assuming that it's impossible for the past to be infinite. When he thinks that that could be possible. Science hasn't ruled that out yet. But notice what Matt's doing here. He's kind of just assuming that consciousness can never arise naturally from matter that is not conscious. So he seems to be doing kind of the same thing here, just with the argument from consciousness. And I'll return to that here as we get forward in the program, because he does something else with the argument that I think I've noticed the problem I have with Matt's critique of the cosmological argument is that if he applied that same skeptical critique to the other arguments for God that he endorses, I think he would have the same problems with those arguments as well, whether it's fine-tuning, the argument from consciousness, morality, whatever it may be. So let's go to episode 463, to that open mailbag, where he continues the discussion, responding to a listener who defends the Kalam cosmological argument, and then Matt gives his responses to him.
Okay, so back to the points being made here. As for the argument itself, there are many different cosmological arguments. The one that was cited there in the email, the one you cited in the email, is the Kalam cosmological argument. I was responding to the claim that everything must have a beginning or a cause, which is an argument that I've heard theists put forward many times. I hear this all the time, in fact. And I was just trying to point out that it's a bad argument because when you say God began or God caused the argument, it leaves you susceptible to the retort of, well, who made God? Because you just said everything has to have a beginning. He's part of everything, isn't he? If everything must have a beginning, then that must include God.
And remember, you got to formulate it right. So for any argument you put forward, you have to have the premises formulated properly and specifically. So sometimes philosophical arguments can get quite technical because you want to formulate them just right. So it's not everything has a cause. It's not everything has a beginning. It's things that begin to exist or things that can fail to exist or things that derive motion from that which is potential. These things require causes. In order to explain this causal chain, you have to have some kind of ultimate cause that is without beginning, without a cause of its own, and that leads you to God.
But if God doesn't have to have a beginning, then that concedes that it's possible, at least, for something not to have a beginning, which means that it's possible for the universe not to have a beginning.
No, it's only possible for something to not have a beginning if it is not temporal at all, and God is outside of time, which we'll get to here very shortly. But if something is within a temporal reality and time moves in a series of events from past to present to future along the arrow of time, as physicists call it, then the arguments from philosophy show it's impossible for the past series of events to be infinite. And we actually have some scientific evidence that this past series has to be finite as well that I'll get to here later.
It's at least logically possible, even if it's not plausible. Now, I know the response to that is to say that God is outside of time and space, and God is not a physical entity, whereas the universe is in time, and it is physical, and thus must have a beginning. But I don't think it's actually true that logically or scientifically everything that is, quote, in time must necessarily have a beginning. I think that that's not true. That strikes me as a bald assertion and nothing more.
Well, it would be an assertion if you just said that and you didn't back it up. But what apologists like William Lane Craig do and others is they put forward philosophical reasons to believe that the past is finite. So for example, one thought experiment, one philosophical tool that I like to show that the past cannot be infinite is to show that infinite causal chains are actually not possible. They lead to contradictions. Someone who's done great work on this is Alexander Pruss. He's a philosopher at Baylor University, and he does a lot of great work with the idea of supertasks. So what is a supertask? It's a task that tries to compress an infinite amount of steps within a finite branch. So to give you an example, one famous supertask is called Thomson's lamp. Imagine you have a lamp, and from 12 o'clock to 1 o'clock, you turn it on and off. So every halfway point, you flip the switch. At 12:30, if it's on at noon, you turn it off at 12:30. You turn it on at 12:45. You turn it off at, what would it be, 12:52 and 30 seconds. So notice how the increments keep getting shorter and shorter and shorter. You're dividing it infinitely so. So then as you're dividing it infinitely and you're turning it on and off, on and off, on and off, you're crossing an infinite number of divisible points, a potential infinite, I would say. You're going through this, the lamp goes on, off, on, off. And so the puzzle with Thomson's lamp is, what is it at 1 o'clock? Because any point you reach, there's always another point you could have added in there for the lamp to be on or the lamp to be off. And so philosophers and mathematicians are puzzled with Thomson's lamp that some of them say, well, it's both on and off at the same time, or the lamp just simply disappears at 1 o'clock to avoid any contradictions. And Craig puts forward similar arguments with Hilbert's hotel. I have my own argument called Aunt Mildred's flower shop. Aunt Mildred has to count flowers before she opens the shop. If she counts 30, not too long, 3 million, probably will take a while. But if it's an infinite number of flowers, the shop never opens. Much the same way, if there's an infinite number of days that must transpire before today happens, then today will never happen. Just like if you have to count an infinite number of flowers in your inventory to open the store never opens. So these are the philosophical reasons that you would put forward in more detail, of course, than what I'm putting here. But you're putting forward an argument to show that an infinite past creates these logical puzzles that can't obtain in reality itself. It's not just a bald assertion that one would make.
And it also doesn't make much sense to say the universe is in time. You know, I hear this all the time, and I don't really know what it means, because first of all, time is relative. So to say that the universe is in it is a bit confusing. I don't know that that actually makes sense as a statement. Maybe it does. Not sure that it does. Also, it could be circular to say that God is allowed to have no beginning because he's outside time and space. The response to that from an atheist could easily be, well, how do you know that God is outside time and space? How do you know that it's even possible for something to be outside of time and space? And if your response to that is, he has to be outside it because he made it, then it's circular. God is outside time and space because he made time and space. And the way that we know he's outside time and space is that he made it. You know, it's a kind of a circular argument.
Now, I would disagree with Matt. I don't think that, now if you put it that way, it is circular. But arriving at the conclusion that God exists beyond space and time is not a circular argument. It would be circular if you said, well, God exists outside of space and time because he made space and time. Well, how do you know that he made space and time? Well, because he exists outside of space and time, and that's how we know that he made it. Well, that would definitely be a circular argument. But if you have other independent reasons to believe that God exists beyond space and time, well, then it's no longer circular. So, for example, if you reach the conclusion that space and time once did not exist, that there was nothing, and then space and time came into existence, if you hold to the conclusion that something cannot come from nothing, you have a cause, and then you discern divine attributes from this cause. Also, if you try to think about what God is, I'm going to do an episode soon. I think next week I'm going to do one on the ontological argument, which is a really fun, quirky kind of argument. The ontological argument has an expression that God is that which no greater can be conceived. So if God, we think about what God is, God has to be the ultimate, right? He's the ultimate in reality. There can't be anything bigger than God. So if something was bigger than God, that would be God. That God is that which no greater can be conceived. He's a maximally great being, is another term used in analytic philosophy. Can't think of anything bigger than God. He's got to be maximal, infinite, beyond all things. And so if that were the case, if God were within space and time, he would be finite. He would not be maximal. He might be reality. You might get pantheism, but you can't get classical theism from that. So if you start from the idea of what God is a kind of maximally great infinite being, then it naturally follows he's not constrained by finite realities if he's infinite. And then, of course, you get the other way. So that's working a priori, starting at the idea of God. You can also start from what you see in the world itself and naturally reason to a reality that exists beyond space and time.
But let's move on to the Kalam cosmological argument. The problem with that argument is that the first two premises aren't necessarily true, and the conclusion doesn't actually prove that God exists. So we've got a nearly irrelevant conclusion built on two faulty premises. So that's why I think it's actually a very bad argument. Premise one, everything that begins to exist has a cause. Well, maybe, but we don't actually know if that's true or not. I think it's true, but it doesn't matter what I think. It matters what you can prove. And you can't prove that. I think most modern scientists, quantum physicists and so forth, would tell you that the laws of cause and effect aren't necessarily as clear as we might think when you get down to the quantum level. And when you go back to the singularity, and then before that, the laws of physics, as we know them, break down. So you can't really make claims based on them, you see. So that premise, I think, is dubious.
All right, let me respond to that. First, when it comes to quantum mechanics, it's funny. I mean, this is the same argument that Lawrence Krauss makes, the atheistic physicist Lawrence Krauss, in his book Universe from Nothing. He says, we see nothing coming, something coming from nothing all the time. But that's an old hat objection. Look, quantum particles coming from quantum vacuums is not something coming from nothing. A quantum vacuum is not nothing. It is fluctuating, a fluctuating mass of extremely low-level energy. So even quantum events, quantum particles have causes. The causes may be indeterminate or completely random that cannot be predicted, but they still has a causal framework nonetheless. Also, the idea that something cannot come from nothing, to me, there's strong evidence to that claim. Here's an argument that I make. I haven't even seen other people make this, even William Lane Craig. I call it the argument from atheism. So I ask atheists, what would change your mind about God? Give me an example of something. And usually it's praying to heal an amputated limb or a miracle. Well, why would a miracle convince you? Because it's something that can't happen in nature. And usually the miracle of it's rising from the dead, making something appear out of nowhere, a amputated limb coming into existence from nothing. If you ask an atheist what would get them to believe in God, all the explanations have one thing in common. It'll be something coming from nothing. Something existing without reference to the natural order. So atheists agree that if something were to come from nothing, that would be a proof for God that would satisfy them. If they don't agree to that, then their atheism is just completely unfalsifiable. But if atheists agree that they would be convinced by seeing something come from nothing in the universe, then I think it would follow that if the universe itself came from nothing, well, that should convince them as well. Second, I think Matt is being inconsistent here, that he likes the argument from consciousness, yet he's making a similar kind of inference. So what's the argument from consciousness? At its bare bones, what Matt is saying in the argument from consciousness is that consciousness, qualia, as philosophers sometimes call it, you know, immaterial thoughts, intentions, feelings, self-awareness. Matt's argument is that he said it's logically impossible. Consciousness cannot come from non-consciousness. So Matt is just saying it is the case that a conscious thing cannot come from no conscious thing. You can't get consciousness from non-consciousness. Well, that belief is grounded in a prior belief, the prior belief that things don't come from non-things or nothing. So if Matt Walsh believes you can't get consciousness from non-consciousness, then he should believe with equal vigor that you can't get things from non-things. Because an atheist could just say, well, fine, Matt, maybe we're conscious because consciousness just emerges from the quantum vacuum with no explanation whatsoever. I highly doubt that Matt would accept that as a good refutation of the argument from consciousness. So if he says that consciousness can't come from non-consciousness, that's affirming an application of the principle that something cannot come from nothing. And in fact, I think the principle something can't come from nothing is stronger than the principle consciousness can't come from non-consciousness, because an atheist could just say, well, maybe consciousness is an emergent property. For example, somebody could say, how could water molecules, H2O, how could water molecules that are not wet come together and make something that is wet like water. All these water molecules don't have wetness, yet when you put them together, you get wetness. Well, the physicists will tell you that wetness is an emergent property. It emerges from a collection of things. It's not intrinsic to every part of the thing that's involved. Now, I don't think that's a satisfactory refutation of the argument, but it's a strong objection to be overcome, which shows that the something from nothing principle is weaker when applied in the consciousness argument than it is just in the Kalam cosmological argument itself.
Premise two, the universe began to exist. Well, even if premise one is conceded, premise two kills the whole thing, because that is a statement of fact, the universe began to exist, when we actually don't know that it is a fact. Remember, you can't bring theological assumptions into this argument. And that's what I was talking about yesterday. The cosmological argument can seem very persuasive to you and me because of the theological assumptions that we bring to it. And those are theological assumptions that I share, that the universe began to exist. But the reason why I think that the universe began to exist, it's not really because of the Big Bang, because as I'll talk about in a minute, the Big Bang itself doesn't prove that the universe began to exist. The reason I think it and believe it is because the Bible tells me that that God created the universe. But in terms of just objective scientific fact, what do we know? Well, we know that the observable universe, this massive clump of 100 billion galaxies that we call the universe, began. We know that. We have no idea what might be beyond that or what might have come before it. We just have no idea. So you simply can't make that claim. Well, you can make it, but it's just a claim. Can't prove it. And there are other logical possibilities. Now, you could say it seems most plausible that the universe began to exist 14.5 billion years ago, whenever it was. But when you equivocate like that, I think it kind of destroys the argument anyway. It is possible, again, I say this from a purely scientific standpoint, that we live in a multiverse, that there are many more. And when you think about it, it's like we know the universe is 100 billion galaxies. Can we really say the universe is 100 billion galaxies? It couldn't possibly be any bigger than that. 100 billion galaxies is incomprehensibly huge already. So you know, who knows? Maybe it's a quadrillion galaxies big, or maybe it's eternally big. I don't know.
But we actually do have evidence. I think here that Matt is just relying on it. And this happens a lot in conversations that people will put forward the Big Bang as evidence for an absolute beginning of the universe. And you're right, they don't consider the hypothesis that our universe emerged from a larger multiverse. Now, a lot of people are familiar with the multiverse. I mean, you've got Into the Spider-Verse, Rick and Morty. I think that Marvel is going to be exploring the multiverse. You got the multiverse all in those CW shows. Everybody knows about the multiverse now. But there is scientific evidence that even the multiverse itself would have to have an absolute beginning. This is something I touched on in my book, Answering Atheism. So I wrote that book back in 2013. And in it, I cited research that was first published in 2003 by three cosmologists, Arvind Bord, Alexander Vilenkin, and Alan Guth. And this is what I wrote. I said these three used relatively simple math, their original paper is only 4 pages long, to determine that any universe that is on average expanding could not have been expanding forever. Their theorem, called the Bord-Vilenkin-Guth or BVG theorem, shows that in an expanding universe, the relative velocity of objects would keep getting faster the more one goes backward in time. But this acceleration into the past can't go on forever. That is because, according to modern physics, nothing can have a relative velocity faster than the speed of light, or 186,000 miles per second. Therefore, in order to stop this increase in relative velocity, there had to be a past boundary or wall, quote-unquote, that designates the beginning of our universe. Now, William Lane Craig made the BVG theorem very popular. I remember way back in the day, because I converted when it was about 2002. The BVG theorem came out in 2003. And Craig was using it already in 2003 and 2004 in his debates with atheists. So I was picking up on it then, reading about it. And then several years later, I saw atheists replying, trying to say, well, you can't use the BVG theorem to show that even a multiverse has an absolute beginning. And a lot of them would pass around a quote from the late atheist Victor Stanger. Stanger's written a lot of books. He's an astronomer, a physicist. He wrote a book called The Fallacy of Fine-Tuning, The Folly of Faith. And so in The Folly of Faith, Stanger emailed Vilenkin and asked him, does your theorem, the Bord-Vilenkin-Guth theorem, does it prove the universe had an absolute beginning? And Stanger quoted a part of Vilenkin's response. He said, no, It doesn't prove it had a beginning, but it proves that the expansion of the universe must have had a beginning. You can evade the theorem by postulating that the universe was contracting prior to some time. So it seems, when Stanger was putting forward Vilenkin's email, that it doesn't prove an absolute beginning. There is an exception to the theorem. But Vilenkin went on to say in the email, the problem was that Stanger eventually published the whole email, and Vilenkin makes this condition that he adds onto it. This sounds as if there is nothing wrong with having contraction prior to expansion. So the idea that the universe is expanding on one side of the singularity, and it began because it's contracting on another side. Maybe it's been infinitely contracting from the other side. We don't know. That's not in Vilenkin's quote. I'm just adding that to you. But Vilenkin goes on to say, but the problem is that a contracting universe is highly unstable. Small perturbations would cause it to develop all sorts of messy singularities, so it would never make it to the expanding phase. That is why Aguirre and Grattan, so that's one model for the beginning of the universe, the Aguirre model, and Carroll and Chen, Sean Carroll, very famous physicist, had to assume that the arrow of time changes at time equals zero. This makes that moment, time equals zero, rather special. I would say no less special than a true beginning of the universe. So that was in 2003 when Bohrd, Vilenkin, Guth published their theorem showing that even a multiverse would have an absolute beginning. And then they reaffirmed it. Vilenkin wrote a paper with Audrey Mathani that was published at ARVIX. It's an online repository of physics papers you can read, really interesting stuff. And in the paper that Mathani and Vilenkin published in 2012, this is what they wrote. Did the universe have a beginning? At this point, it seems that the answer to this question is probably yes. And so it went on from there. In my book, Answering Atheism, I dealt with Leonard Susskind's critique of it. But Susskind is another physicist who ends up saying that, well, maybe there is a beginning, but in any kind of inflating cosmology where a universe expands, the beginning is so far back, it's at minus infinity. So you have a beginning, but it's infinitely far away. So it's basically no beginning. And if Susskind argues that, as I point out in the book, he's arguing philosophy more than science. But notice that Vilenkin and Mathani, they say the answer is probably yes. So that's science. It doesn't give you definitive answers. It gives you tentative answers. So that's why I like to say that there is scientific evidence that points towards the absolute beginning of the universe, even a multiverse, from nothing. But that's why I prefer the philosophical arguments for the beginning of the past, because they give you more of a definitive proof that you would put forward. So I would just disagree with Matt that we have evidence. It's not definitive, but nothing in science is. I mean, he's not going to find definitive scientific evidence that consciousness is impossible from a naturalistic framework, but you'll find interesting scientific research that points against it. And I would say we have the same thing here when it comes to scientific evidence for the beginning of either our local universe or a larger multiverse.
It's possible that the universe is like an accordion that expands and contracts eternally. It's possible. There are dozens of other possibilities as well. So I think that claim that the premise doesn't work. And then
I will say that model he's talking about, the contracting universe, that our universe expands from a big bang and then it contracts again in a big crunch, and it goes big bang, big crunch, big bang, big crunch, an oscillating universe that expands and contracts for an infinite amount of cycles. I would say that there's actually evidence against that because we have a large amount of dark matter in our universe. Physicists have shown there's enough matter in the universe to keep it expanding forever. So you can imagine like a rope and a boat. If the boat is small enough, the boat pulls away from the dock, but then the rope pulls the boat back. So there's a tug between the boat moving away and the rope pulling it back. In our universe, the boat would be matter and the rope is gravity. So if gravity is really, really strong, the boat ain't going nowhere. But if the boat is really, really huge and gravity is weak in comparison to it, like you have a small rope trying to tie a cruise liner up, cruise liner is going to bust that rope in a second and keep going. And that's what physicists believe about our universe, that the Big Bang, Big Crunch model, it actually doesn't really work. I would also say that Matt hasn't discussed that he's invoking the multiverse to try to undermine the cosmological argument when he likes the fine-tuning argument, yet that's one of the atheist's favorite objections to the fine-tuning argument is the multiverse objection, which I don't have time to get into here, but maybe in a future episode on the fine-tuning argument, we could get to that. But I just find it odd. I feel like he's kind of picking on this argument, especially the Kalam version. We're not even getting into the Thomistic version or the contingency argument, which assume the universe could be eternal and still require a reason for why it exists instead of does not exist, which I find those arguments to be very, very powerful. But just with Kalam, I feel like he's kind of treating it in a harsher way than he would some of these other arguments. That if his other arguments, if he likes those, he should like this one too.
Conclusion, you know, because you say, well, it's all, you know, here are the two premises, then we get to the conclusion that the universe has a cause. Well, that even if you get there, I mean, even if you can convince someone of the first two premises, which I'm not sure how exactly you do that, because you're going to need to come forward with scientific discoveries that no one, you're going to need to have some heretofore unknown scientific discoveries that you're bringing to bear for those premises to work. But even if you do, the conclusion only shows that something caused the universe. It doesn't tell you that that thing is God, you see. It doesn't even really get you close to that, because anybody could dream up a million different logical possibilities of what that thing could be.
Once again, this is an objection you could level at many of the other arguments that Matt likes. I mean, maybe there is some other explanation for why we have consciousness that isn't God. It's just something that is immaterial in nature, but doesn't have divine attributes like necessary existence, omnipotence, omniscience. It's just immaterial some way, some kind of immaterial reality, especially with fine tuning. Or I think Matt has said he likes the origin of life arguments. He'll get into that here kind of more at the end of the show. But let's take, you know, fine tuning that shows a designer of the universe. But it doesn't follow immediately. It shows the universe is designed, but I find the fine-tuning argument is helpful when it's conjoined to like the cosmological argument, because the Kalam argument gives you a cause that is immaterial, timeless, spaceless, extremely powerful. And we'll get to Matt's critique of that here in a second. But you know, the design arguments, it gets you a designer. And Matt goes on here to say that maybe the cause of the universe is a simulation in another universe. Well, yeah, what if the fine tuner is just some kid in some physics class in another universe? I think there's an old movie way back in the day, old, like the 90s probably. It's like called The 13th Floor or something like that. Help me out, people. You could leave a comment here. It was an old movie about people trying to create a simulation, and they create a simulated reality. And the big twist in the movie was that they are part of a simulated reality, and they're the first simulated reality to go on and make their own simulation. So the fine-tuning argument could give you some physics kid in a, you know, in another universe or something. But I think the cosmological arguments give you more the classical divine attributes, especially like the Thomistic arguments and the contingency argument, but Kalam to a big extent as well.
William Lane Craig, who first of all is brilliant, and I'm a huge fan of him. I admire and respect him. I think most of his arguments that he makes are great. But this is the Kalam cosmological argument is one that he popularized. And on this one, I think it's not good. And I think he kind of pulls a little bit of a rhetorical bait and switch, not intentionally, but I think he does. Because what he'll try to do, if you've ever heard him explain this argument, he'll try to get from, you know, the universe has a cause, and then he'll go immediately from that and say, and that cause must be timeless, spaceless, immaterial, changeless, and infinitely powerful. And then he'll say, and that's whatever, and you know, whatever being is that is God. That's what we all mean when we say God. Well, that doesn't really work logically, does it? Because yeah, whatever caused it, I guess, would have to be immaterial, spaceless, and timeless, because it is outside of those things. Although even there, you could dream up, you know, you could say, well, what if the universe is simulation in some sort of alien supercomputer? I don't think that's true, but it's a logical possibility that you can't rule out logically, philosophically, you can't rule it out.
Well, if you have the philosophical argument that a temporal series of events cannot be infinite into the past, then it would just follow that that kid's universe, that temporal, spatio-temporal universe that physics kid lives in, who made our universe, it had to have a beginning. So the chain eventually reaches some kind of terminus, no matter how many universes you have to go through. And then you have this cause of all of reality, and we want to know, well, what are the attributes of this cause? And Matt's already conceded that, you know, it gets you an eternal, immaterial being, but he has problems with some of the other arguments.
So even that doesn't really work. But let's put the alien simulation thing aside, and let's say, okay, fine, spaceless, timeless, immaterial. But how do you get to changeless and infinitely powerful? Whatever caused the universe, the act of causing the universe doesn't mean that you have to be changeless. And it doesn't even mean you have to be infinitely powerful. It just means that you have to be the spark that sets off the Big Bang, and then everything sort of takes over from there. Infinitely powerful means that you can do things like things God can do, like read your mind and answer prayers. But there is nothing about starting a universe that necessitates being able to read someone's mind and answer their prayers, for example. And that's why deists through the centuries have...
Once again, okay, but then maybe I guess you could say that if somebody gives us consciousness, they know how consciousness works, and so they can read our thoughts and hear our prayers. I mean, if I met somebody that could read my thought, I mean, read what I'm thinking, I wouldn't necessarily think that they're God. Maybe they're Professor X. Maybe they're a telepath. You know, they have some ability to tap into my mind, or they have a way to read my neurons and track them towards how, you know, if you measure my brain activity when I do certain things, then you can make guesstimates based on that. I don't know. But even that, or the fine-tuning argument, it's funny, these other arguments, you don't get the strongest divine attributes either. I think the arguments that give you the best divine attributes, I say, are the cosmological arguments, because they are the ones that have the whole scope of reality into them. So, for example, like the contingency argument, that we have something that is necessary, and if it's necessary in existence, it can't depend on anything else. If it depended on other things, it would be contingent. And so that naturally shows this, whatever this being is that created the universe, exists without limits, without divisions within itself. So like the contingency argument, and especially the argument from motion that Ed Fazer defends in his book, Five Proofs for the Existence of God, based on Aquinas. Like Aquinas' argument really gets you a lot of the attributes. Because if you come to the end of St. Thomas Aquinas' argument that there is a cause of motion and change that is pure actuality, actus purus, pure actuality that has no potentiality in it whatsoever, then you get something that is necessary, that is simple, that is pure act, that is not within space or time, because it can't, it would have potentialities if it was within those things, that would be all powerful, because if there was something it could potentially do, but it couldn't, it wouldn't be pure act, that would have all knowledge, because it couldn't have potential knowledge that it needs to learn. It would be all good, because it would be the fullness of being. And a lot of philosophers, and especially those in the Thomistic tradition, would say that evil occurs when you have an absence of being or an absence of goodness. So if God is pure act itself, he would have to be all good. Now, I would say, though, even if you go with the Kalam argument, you get a lot of these attributes. So, for example, when it comes to omnipotence, Matt's not impressed with making a universe. Well, I'm impressed with that, because if you can make something from nothing, I would say there's nothing you couldn't do. Like, if my superpower was making something from nothing, I would just obliterate the Marvel universe. If I can make something from nothing, like, man, I don't know how any of those people would be able to anything logically possible from nothing. If I could do that, you know, I don't think the Avengers and Thanos teamed up together with the Infinity Gauntlet. They ain't going to stop me if I can make something from nothing. So one argument the Christian apologist Doug Gruthus puts forward is this. It's the weightlifter analogy. If a weightlifter can lift 1,000 pounds, then he can lift 300 pounds. So if a being can do the hardest thing out there, which is making something from nothing, then nothing else would be a challenge for him, and then that being would be all powerful. So that's one way to get that divine attribute from the Kalam argument.
I believe that the universe was caused by some sort of supernatural entity, and then that entity really hasn't done anything since, or maybe isn't able to do anything else, or maybe doesn't even exist anymore. I don't think that's true, but it's there's nothing illogical about it, is my point. Okay. And that's why I think that that argument is no good. That's why I think we should focus again on, you know, argument from consciousness, the moral argument, fine-tuning, origin of life, I think, is a much better argument than the cosmological argument, because it's built on, as I tried to explain, it's built on premises that are not provable. And if they're not provable, then they don't really work. And they're also not logically necessary.
This is, and we're coming to the end here. Actually, I think I've covered everything I wanted to cover with this response. And thanks for staying with me, by the way. I'm looking at my timer. I'm like, you know, when it gets past a half hour, it's like, am I going to call the show? No, none of us have anywhere to be. So we might as well stick around and listen to good stuff. So this is where my biggest baffle that has boggled me, you know, it's like my mind is in a boggle. I'm boggled that Matt thinks the origin of life argument and the consciousness argument. So origin of life would say, this is an argument I don't really like. We don't know how life could emerge from non-life. So if the Earth was lifeless 4.5 billion years ago, and then life emerged from non-life, let's say amino acids, the basic building blocks of proteins or something like that, that could not happen naturally since life can't come from non-life. Therefore, God must have done that. And so I just don't like that argument because I think it's kind of God of the gaps. It's like, well, maybe there is a natural way that we are made out of chemicals and atoms. Maybe there's a natural way that atoms can come together to create a living organism. I don't believe atoms can come together to make a living organism with an immortal soul. And I think even our consciousness has ultimately divine explanations to it. But if Matt is impressed by the idea that you cannot get life from non-life, therefore, God is the cause. You cannot get consciousness from non-consciousness. Therefore, God is the cause. Then he should be impressed by the cosmological argument. You can't get stuff from non-stuff, things from non-things, something from nothing. You cannot do that. So therefore, God must be the cause of the universe when we properly formulate it. So hope this is helpful for you. If you want other great resources on this, you can check out my book, Answering Atheism. You want to go more in depth, William Lane Craig on the Kalam argument is great. His book, Reasonable Faith, Creation Ex Nihilo with Paul Copan is also very good. If you want the contingency argument, good people who have written on that are Alex Pruss has an entry in the Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology. Josh Rasmussen. Actually, I'll give a plug here to Classical Theist Podcast. Go over there. I think Rasmussen has been interviewed by my friend John DeRosa, a classical theist. Rasmussen is a good defender of the contingency argument. He's got a book on that. I forget the title. It's like how thinking leads to God. Look up Josh Rasmussen. He's up at Azusa Pacific. He's not too far from me. I should have him down for an interview. And of course, if you want a Thomistic cosmological argument, you can't go wrong with Ed Fazer, Five Proofs of the Existence of God, or Aquinas, A Beginner's Guide. So there's your homework. You got lots of time to read books and other great things. Thank you all for sticking with me. And just a reminder, I think Matt Walsh is a cool guy. I love Matt Walsh. I don't agree with everything he says. Obviously, there's nobody I agree with all the time, except for Jesus. Everything he says, that guy knows what he's talking about. But I enjoy a lot of what Matt Walsh says, and I appreciate the work that he does. I'd love to even sit down and chat with him because I think there's a ton that we would agree about. I just disagree with him on this point he brought up here in the podcast. So I hope that's a helpful perspective for you all. You all have been awesome, and I hope you have a very blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.